the Victoria Rumble Room, an island show that likes to honor tradition, like Easter. Happy Easter to everyone. Important to get together with family and friends. I'm Robin Adair, and joining me, my co-host, John Jurisic, who I count as a good friend. And Johnny, we're here now to talk for a few minutes about Pride in Place.
Absolutely, Robin. Quite possibly my only friend, so I thank you for that. We live in a time when people apparently love to tear down traditions, tearing down our leaders. It's rampant. If you ever wonder why it's difficult to get good people to run for public office, look around. Just check out social media anywhere at any time and witness the abuse that public figures and elected officials at a minimum suffer on a regular basis. And we have a couple of good examples to draw upon, don't we?
And I think first in line for that is Catherine, Princess of Wales. And of course, she is the future Queen of Great Britain, the future Queen of Canada. She's also the mother of a future king. And last I looked, we should still feel great pride in having a royal family. We're still part of the Commonwealth. It hasn't been thrown asunder yet. It was reported that Princess Kate was ill. She had to go in for surgery. And then there was innuendo, a lot of it on social media, that there was something wrong in their marriage, that there might be a third party involved in some sort of bad goings on, a lot of bad things being said. And some of the comments made about the royals at that point was rabid on social media. But now we hear that she has cancer. Kate has cancer. And I suggest even the haters and the anti-monarchists need to stand back and feel compassion for a mother who is under threat.
The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I'm now in the early stages of that treatment. This, of course, came as a huge shock, and William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family.
Robin, as you, as all of our viewers, all of my friends know, I'm an active participant on social media. I actually, as a consultant, sell those services. This was a runaway conspiracy train that I haven't seen in a long time. Unbelievable. Truly tragic that Kate has now announced that she has cancer. We've all lost people to cancer. And for anyone not to feel tremendous sympathy for her, well, I say, shame on you. And while I'm at it, a lot of people have had mixed feelings about our 18th Prime Minister, Brian Mulroney, late Brian Mulroney, a man who delivered free trade, recognized Ukraine as a nation, helped stop acid rain, and won two massive majority governments. Well, I hope people have been giving his legacy a hard second thought. Here's what his daughter had to say in a packed Montreal cathedral.
In our grief, our family is comforted and so grateful for the universal outpouring of affection and admiration for what my father meant to them and to Canada. While he didn't care for polls, he did like good headlines. And those of the past few weeks would have pleased him immeasurably.
You know, John, we're living in an age right now where it seems like it's the thing to do to attack attack people in office and to go after leadership of all types and to rewrite the history books, all this wokeism that's going on. For example, I thought it was a disgrace the way they went after Sir John A. Macdonald, Canada's first prime minister, to the point that they actually carted off a statue of Sir John A. in front of Victoria's City Hall. And there wasn't a lot of discussion in advance of that. It's disappeared. It hasn't come back. Also, Captain Cook's statue was dragged down by a mob down in the Inner Harbor. No one got arrested. Nobody's wrist got slapped. No comment, hardly. People weren't happy about it, but this sort of thing goes on. And Queen Victoria, her statue in front of the legislature, smeared with red paint. A radical minority is busily rewriting the history books right now, and some recent history certainly deserves to be stood up and celebrated. And such is the case for Brian Mulroney, I believe, one of Canada's great prime ministers.
You're right, Robin. The radical minority is trying to rewrite history. Brian Mulroney took a lot of chances. He was creative. He was innovative. He was a phenomenal leader. However, free trade wasn't universally accepted. But it's built massive trade links vital to Canada's economy. Mulroney's goods and services tax was slagged from many corners as a tax grab. But when Liberal Jean Chrétien eventually tossed out the Conservatives, and boy did he ever, he kept the GST because it was a good idea.
And, you know, many of our leaders these days, they seem more intent on getting reelected than necessarily taking the risks to solve the big problems. Brian Mulroney did what he thought was best at the time. And he also had the instinct to know when it was time to leave. He brought in the GST because he knew it was the right thing. He saw the anger about it. People were misinformed. They were frustrated. They said, we don't want to pay that tax. Even though, of course, they were going to have to pay a tax of some kind. He didn't stick around to see what people felt. And, you know, Kim Campbell stood in and she got hammered out. But Jean Chrétien, he campaigned against the GST. Once he became prime minister, he said, oh, we'll keep the GST. It's a good tax. So Brian Mulroney was right. And, you know, in British Columbia right now, the NDP is riding extremely high in the opinion polls. And so we're curious to see, are they making the right decisions? We asked Royal Road's Dr. David Black, who has studied and indeed looked very hard at what David Eby has been doing since he became premier. Well, we wanted to know what he felt his chances were of re-election next fall.
What we saw in the 100-day speech in October 2022, which is really, I think, established the campaign map for David Eby, that's still intact today, certainly reflected in the throne speech and the budget in February, is that those four issues, public safety, environment, affordability, including housing and health, were in 2022 and will be in 2024, the issues in which this government will campaign. Let's you know, be fair-minded. These are wickedly difficult problems to solve. And even with a government that, you know, a government of the center left that is willing perhaps to override, say, municipal governments, to reach into the economy in ways that a government of the center right might not. Some of these problems may be beyond the scope of any government to fix in any kind of consummately satisfying way. Houses will probably never be as cheap as they were, you know, decades ago. We may not be able to get a doctor, you know, to make a house call anymore going forward. But I think what the public is looking for is good faith effort and expenditure toward fixing some of these problems. And I think what the NDP government has been able to do is at least show that they're trying. I think because these problems are long term and difficult to solve, I didn't expect they would solve them in this election cycle. All they can do is ask the public to believe that the efforts they're making will lead long-term results going forward.
The provincial election is obviously still months away, but if you believe the polls, the NDP is going to be pretty hard to beat. Looks like they're going to slide in with another majority. Angus Reid had them at 43% support of decided voters. BC Conservatives and BC United in a virtual tie at 22 and 21% respectively.
You know, it's interesting you say that they look like they're going to win, but it's hard to say this far out. Things can change immeasurably in a month, let alone several months. We just don't know what's going to happen. And of course, the polls, they don't always mirror each other. There's a Main Street survey that has David Eby at 40% with the NDP, and that's decided voters. BC Conservatives only 6 points back of that at 34%. BC United support at 15%. And the Green Party just behind them at 11. And so what's the deal with this BC Conservative Party? Is it real? And will the vote splitting indeed give David Eby a cakewalk all the way into office next fall? Well, we thought we would turn now to BC's official opposition leader for some answers, the man who actually changed the name of the party from the BC Liberals to BC United. And he's still waiting for that name to take hold. Kevin Falcon's here. Let's zoom him in. And now joining us in the Rumble Room, once again, the leader of the BC United political party, and so great to have you back on the show, Kevin Falcon.
Great to be here, Robin, as the leader of the, not only the BC United, but leader of the official opposition.
Well,
great
that's true.
To be with you and John.
That's true. We didn't want to miss that. Now, we just heard a clip from Dr. David Black from Royal Roads University. He suggests that people in BC are fairly patient with this NDP government, and that David Eby also benefits from the opposition being so split. And you yourself have to be kind of concerned about this BC Conservative Party. There's just a new poll out. Polling Canada survey done by Mainstream Research shows the NDP at 40%. The Conservatives, it says, are trailing at 34%, and your party, BC United, is at 15%. Now, I realize that's only one poll, and I realize we're still months from an election, but you must be worried about this.
Yeah. Well, first of all, not so worried about Main Street polling, because frankly, their polls are always like way out there. The Angus Reid poll that came out recently, just a couple of days before, I think is much more realistic. It shows us tied with the BC Conservatives. That strikes me as being more realistic based on what I see and feel out there. But of course, look, we're always concerned about vote splitting. The BC Conservative Party has been a party that's been around for like 70 years. They're not connected to the federal party at all. But what they are doing is trying to make it look like they're one and the same. And that voter confusion that gets created is just that. It's voter confusion. And I don't worry about it as much as you might think I would, because I know that 7 months from an election, the public's not even focusing on provincial politics right now. When they start to pay attention to provincial politics and they look and say, okay, what are our choices now? If I'm unhappy with the NDP, which over half the public in that same poll, which is, you know, as I say, I think it's a very problematic poll, but over half the public is saying it's time for a change. And in the Angus Reid polls, you can see that there's very, very strong dissatisfaction with how the NDP are managing the healthcare system, crime, affordability. Those are the big issues in the province right now. And the numbers that they are seeing there are just awful if you're in government. So what happens with the public is they, you know, as they start to pay more attention, which is probably, frankly, not until a month before the election, when they really start turning their mind to the options, they're going to discover that the BC Conservative Party isn't headed by Pierre Poilievre. They're going to suddenly see this other guy, John Rustad, who is, believe me, is no Pierre Poilievre. And they're going to be like, well, who is he? And, you know, and then they're going to realize, oh, okay, this isn't the Federal Conservative Party. This is a totally different group of people.
Yeah. Just on that specific thing, and my apologies for interrupting. And this is something that certainly comes up a lot, this linkage from BC Conservatives to the Federal Conservatives, and that their growing support federally is spilling over to BC, just as you mentioned. Obviously frustrating, considering you're very much, you know, a person on the right side of the ledger, and have been most of your life and associated with conservatives federally, outside of their, but let's focus on some of their actual policies, the BC Conservatives. Outside of their opposition to vaccine mandates and questions about climate change science, can you identify what are the differences between your parties?
It's hard to do because they're not a policy driven party, to be honest with you. They're more of a PPC type party, you know, the provincial version of the PPC party federally, and Max Bernier's party. And I think that, you know, my experience 30 years in politics is that the public in BC is, they're not extreme on either side. Most of the public is pretty mainstream, and I'm a mainstream conservative. I think that most people probably reflect something close to my and our views as BC United. But look, the fact of the matter is BC United is the coalition party. We always have been historically, whether we've been called BC United, BC Liberals, or prior to that, the old Social Credit Party. That is, and we are the coalition party. Now, yes, they're going to enjoy some voter confusion in the polls early on, but that's going to go away. I promise you that will dissipate by the time we get around to the election. And then as the public starts looking around for what is the alternative? So for over half the population that think it's time for a change, when they look around and say, okay, what is the alternative? Yes, they will take a look at the BC Conservatives, but when they realize that that's not a federal Conservative Party, it's a totally different party. When they look at the kind of candidates that they've got running for them, when you look at the policies that we have and we put forward, when you look at the fact that we have 26 experienced MLAs that you know represent every part of the province, I am pretty confident that we won't have any trouble being the alternative and the coalition party that historically we always have been.
You know, we have a big issue right now, and Pierre Poilievre, I have to keep mentioning his name, is pounding away right now at the carbon tax. There have been premiers across the country are saying they're not going to continue the carbon tax. Now, Mr. Eby says that he will. It's about to rise again. And the BC Conservatives, of course, have jumped on this bandwagon. You have spoken against the carbon tax, but does it hurt your credibility that you're with a party that was formerly a government that actually brought in Canada's first carbon tax? I mean, how can you say it was fine then and it's bad now?
Oh, very easily. And it's a great question because, you know, when we brought in, when Gordon Campbell brought in North America's first revenue neutral carbon tax, it was exactly the right approach because what it said was that by law, every nickel generated from that tax had to be returned to the public in the form of lower personal income taxes and lower small business taxes. And that's the right approach. It was a tax shift. And what happened, what changed, and the reason why I cannot and will not support what it has morphed into under the NDP is that when they got elected in 2017, they took away, they changed the law to say, we're now taking all that money into government. And then they more than doubled the carbon tax. Now they're increasing it on April 1st by a further 23%. And they want to triple it by 2030. There is no way I'm going to sign on to something like that, because what this has become is a way to pick the pockets of British Columbians. And they keep trying to say, oh, yes, but we provide some rebates to take away the sting. Well, that's fine if you're earning less than $60,000. Anyone, any couple earning more than $60,000 a year is getting zero. And it's just not supportable in this present approach. And the other thing is, too, I think it's important to understand, what are we trying to achieve here? We are trying to achieve emission reductions, right? The best way that British Columbia, which only represents 0.17% of global emissions, okay, so we are a rounding error in terms of global emissions, to the point where we could shut down the entire province, turn off every vehicle, turn off every light, lit, sit in darkness, and it would represent less than 2 days of emissions out of China. That's something we have to keep in mind. So what are we trying to achieve here? I would argue, as part of a global citizenry, we have an obligation to help reduce emissions globally. We can do that through our green tech, our exporting of green technology and a lot of the brains and technology that we have here in BC. But we can also do it by exporting something we have a lot of, which is natural gas in a liquefied form as LNG, which we then ship to Asia. Then we get China to move off of coal-fired power, which is the dirtiest, uncleanest form of emissions, reduce their emissions by 50% just by having them transition to LNG. That would be the equivalent of parking every vehicle in the country here in Canada. So I would way rather do something that's meaningful than to do something that is virtue signaling and is really about picking the pockets of British Columbians at a time when they cannot afford it.
Kevin, your answers are beautifully sort of evolving into my next question. We didn't share these questions with you. So thank you. So we're shifting to energy, which you now have mentioned in your answer with regard to the carbon tax. I know you're a big supporter of LNG, but what about this massive push by Ottawa to move to electric energy? A study by the Fraser Institute says Ottawa's current EV mandate would require the equivalent of 10 new mega hydro dams, 13 large natural gas plants across the country in the next decade. Where's the middle ground for energy sustainability?
Yeah, well, this is the problem. Those kind of mandates in the province is following their David Eby and the NDP are walking lockstep with the federal Liberals in this regard, and it's ridiculous. First of all, understand that most families cannot afford to spend $70,000 plus on an electric vehicle. We just have to understand this. I meet many, many British Columbians who get by buying a used vehicle that may have cost $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000, so that they can have the ability to drive their child to dance classes or art classes, or to do their job as a tradesperson. So we just have to understand that trying to impose something like that on the public is ridiculous. Most of the take up on electric vehicles has been done early on. The early adopters are people that are wealthy, quite frankly, and they can easily make this transition. But most families can't. And so putting something like that in place, I think, is wrong. The second thing that's problematic about it is a lot of these policies have not been thought through at all. So the NDP have a policy called Clean BC. We call it Kill BC because it will effectively kill BC's economy. Their own, and this isn't me saying it, their own economic modeling shows that it will have a disastrous economic impact by shrinking the GDP, which is the gross domestic product of this province, by 10%. Costing 200,000 plus jobs in the resource sector primarily, but frankly, with impacts right across the province, for what benefit? So I really want your listeners to understand this. This is really important. In 2010, I was with Gordon Campbell, Fort St. John, when we announced we were going ahead with the Site C Dam, okay? In the teeth of opposition from the NDP, who were in opposition at the time, and a whole bunch of other environmental groups that said, don't you dare do this. Look at the impact it's going to have on farmlands. The reason we did that was because we were thinking generationally. We were thinking about the next generation. And we also had, as you recall, independent power projects, which were wind power, solar power, run-of-the-river power projects, where the private sector came in and made investments, and then were able to sell that power into the grid because we wanted energy self-sufficiency. We said that that was going to be the underwriting of our entire clean energy policy in BC, energy self-sufficiency. The NDP not only opposed Site C, and they were wrong, they canceled a lot of our independent power projects because they said they were corporate giveaways. Then they took out the energy self-sufficiency requirement we had in our clean energy program. And because of that, what have we seen? We've seen them reverse position on Site C. Now they're supporting Site C, even though they've mismanaged and bungled the project. It's going to cost more than double of what it should have. They're now going out and doing a call for 3,000 megawatt of power. What is it? Independent power projects, asking the private sector to come in to help on power. But, how wrong can this government possibly be on this issue? And I'm so concerned about the direction they're taking us in, because, it's going to create a huge crisis for us coming soon to a home near you.
We'll be talking more to Kevin Falcon about housing, public safety in the weeks ahead. He has a lot of ground to cover, if he hopes to overtake the BC Conservatives and put BC United back in the W column. But he's enthusiastic, and let's face it, that was a great interview.
And, you could say the same thing when it comes to enthusiasm about Warren Skullrood, who is the man who got behind the petition that is calling for the return of rail service to Vancouver Island. Was able to get 7,600 names on the petition. It went to Ottawa. And what happened? Well, not exactly sure what happened, except that we know that Ottawa is still in conversation with First Nations and stakeholders. No word at all about him asking for $1 billion to get the rail service up and going. But Warren says, with government talks continuing, the hope remains. And so he and other rail supporters will keep up the pressure. And as far as they're concerned, it's full steam ahead.
I'll keep pushing it forward. I'm a cautiously optimistic person, but I think if people continue looking at it from the point of view of, well, we don't have the voting power to get them interested and all that kind of stuff. I think if we take that attitude and we lay down and say, well, I hope they do it, well, that will never happen. Like, it will never happen without some pressure. Langford to Victoria is only 7.6 miles. It would take one train to do service every 40 minutes back and forth, including the stops. Two trains, it would be every 20 minutes. And that's not disturbing the car traffic, other than just going across a few intersections. It's not taking a bus lane, like they're building bus lanes and stuff like that, where, I don't think that any more road expansions are going to include lanes for cars. It's going to be all about creating busways so that they can get past all the congestion.
You know, we ran an earlier interview with Warren where he talked about the benefits of First Nations taking a leadership role with this rail proposal. Certainly, in this time of reconciliation, it might be the best way to get serious government interest in the project. And as always, we've got some feedback to this island rail restoration effort.
That's right. We've heard from Jill, who's a big supporter of the Rumble Room. He's written us before, and he's really interested in this. And he was talking about the fact that in Arizona, they have a program that he's quite intrigued with. It seems that the federal and provincial governments are not willing to fund an island rail service due to the possible cost of $1 billion. So why not have them consider a wide cycle walk path for local enthusiasts and tourists? I realize that large freight could not be carried, but a fully paved path could be used by everyone.
Thanks for this, Shales. I'm an avid e-bike rider. Support these comments. Nonetheless.
Apparently they do it in Tucson, John. That's what they're doing in Tucson. So he wanted to recommend that.
Well, damn good idea. But so is moving freight in an ever-increasing economy on Vancouver Island. I suppose if a solid final no comes from Ottawa and the legislature, then maybe they'll consider that as an option. But I'm sure that Warren and the train lobby will keep up the pressure to see rail restored. So we'll keep an eye on the situation and wish them all well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And boy, for an Easter show, it's just jam-packed, John. Lots of different things going on, and looking forward to further shows down the road. But for now, maybe we could just talk about how people can follow the Rumble Room, the different ways and different means that you can use to be able to tune in on a regular basis and become part of the Rumble Room family.
Yeah, and boy, do we have an expansive family on social media. Once again, huge thanks to at least 1.7 million cumulative views who've tuned into our show since we got this project started a little while back. More specifically, if you're on YouTube, see the link. Please hit the subscribe button. Like these sessions that you and I have. Enjoy our clips, which go rampant on TikTok. Obviously, other ways that you can follow us, Facebook, on X, and Twitter, and YouTube, as I just mentioned. You can also listen to us on a podcast through your headphones while you're running or biking down the island corridor. And obviously Instagram and TikTok. As I remain, yet again and constantly, the Croatian sensation, really truly wishing everyone the best for this Easter holiday season. Be safe. Some people know this weekend and this break is a school break. It doesn't matter. Take care. My name is John Jurisic.
And enjoy your Easter. And I rarely take a break, just to be very clear about that, because I'm so busy organizing for the next big rumble as we rumble on.